Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Greed, arrogance, and lust led Robert Anderson to kill his wife of nearly 20 years. He was a pillar of the community. He owned four ServiceMaster franchises. He was a Kiwanis member and former president and a former teacher and athletic director at Salem High School. The combination of his love for money and infatuation with a younger girl led him to the brutal beating of his wife and subsequent attempt to frame an employee and former student. The death of his wife in Lawrence, Massachusetts, was considered an extreme act of rage and was initially attributed to the violence that was pervasive in the city at the time. The homicide was subsequently compared to the murder of Carol Stewart by her husband Charles Stewart 5 years earlier in Boston. That Stewart murder was also initially attributed to the violence of the city. Follow investigators from three agencies as they follow the evidence and track their quarry. In the end, justice reigned. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder Outside the Back Door, the true story of the murder of a popular Salem, New Hampshire teacher by her husband, the murder labeled as a Charles Stewart copycat, with my special guest, author John Tomasi.
Dan, how you doing? And thanks for having me. I enjoyed these podcasts.
Thank you so much for joining me with this Murder Outside the Back Door. Let's get right to this February 4th, 1984. Detective Phillips and the Salem is at the Salem Police Department. And so Andrew McGregor, his wife Linda, and daughter Cindy are there concerning an assault by a person named Robert Anderson. Tell us about what happens that day, what they tell Detective Phillips.
Well, Cindy McGregor was a cheerleader at Central Catholic. And they said that Robert Anderson, the athletic director, he also taught gym classes, approached Cindy McGregor in the locker room and essentially assaulted her by starting to fondle her. And it was definitely unwanted. And Cindy pushed him away and she went home, told her parents, and her parents came right to the police station.
Now they have to speak to this Robert Anderson. So what does Robert Anderson do when he's asked about these allegations?
He denied everything. He said, no, this didn't happen. You know, I did talk to her initially from outside the door of the girls' locker room because his office was in close proximity. And again, he just continued to deny everything.
Now, what does Cindy and her parents offer to do? Because they're adamant that Cindy is telling the truth and they want charges to be laid, potentially.
She agreed to take a polygraph. And it wasn't Detective Phillips who brought it up. It was the family. And she passed two polygraphs. And Cindy McGregor is known to me. She had married my cousin, Tim Brady, a couple of years later. And Tim Brady is the boyfriend that was mentioned in the book later on.
Now, she passes this second polygraph, and this second polygraph is asked for by the attorney for Robert Anderson, as an independent polygraph examiner. So she passes that test. So police do what in terms of a warrant and arrest?
Well, they put out a warrant for his arrest. And Robert Anderson was a very highly respected individual in the community. He was a member of the Kiwanis. He eventually became president of the Kiwanis. And now they wanted to handle him with kid gloves, but as the saying goes, no one is above the law. So he turned himself in with his lawyer, John McCool, after the warrant was issued for his arrest.
It's very interesting. There was a petition signed by about 400 students. What was this petition and what was it detailing?
What it said was they're not saying whether he was guilty or innocent, but they were in support of him. A lot of the students loved him. He hired one or two of his students at ServeMaster for latter years. But, you know, essentially it came out in support and was published in the local newspaper, the Salem Observer.
Now, there's a 3-day trial for him with judge only. Interesting aspect of that is it's unusual for a defendant to take the stand. You talk about Anderson taking the stand at this trial and then the verdict in this 3-day trial.
Yeah. The verdict was not guilty. It was moved. There was a change of venue to Hampton Beach. Judge Frazier, very highly respected, and he would be what you called a cop's judge. He was more conservative, and if someone assaulted a police officer, there's a good chance they were going to jail. But after the jury trial, the reason why Anderson didn't want to have a jury trial, and I spoke to John McCool afterwards, was they were worried that the jury may sympathize with McGregor family. So they felt that the Anderson team with John McCool, felt that the state didn't have enough to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Part of the reason of the reasonable doubt was a longtime friend of Robert and also of the couple, he and his wife as well. A person named Ray Corliss basically gave some very damning testimony or support of Robert Anderson.
Yeah, that is true. Supposedly, Tim Brady, Cindy's boyfriend, went to talk to Anderson and said, hey, listen, what can we do to make this go away? Now, there's no doubt in my mind that didn't happen because, again, Tim Brady's my cousin. I know him very well. So Anderson got his friend, who also happened to work for Anderson. Anderson was his direct boss. And he testified that, yeah, I heard Tim Brady say that to Anderson. And again, I think that was made up because what I say a lot of time in my books is the best judge of future behavior is past behavior. A number of years later, Anderson was also accused of an assault. And he tried to get one of his employees to say that never happened, but she eventually told Methuen police the next town over that, no, Anderson put her up to do it. So I think that Anderson put his subordinate up to doing it.
You write about Robert's wife, and her name is Amy, and she is supportive of him and thinks that this woman has put them through personal hell.
Amy said that, yeah, this girl put my husband through hell. She stood behind her. Amy was an extremely popular English teacher at Salem High, and they loved her. As a matter of fact, she had attended Salem High before she went to college, and she got voted Miss Salem High. She was a beautiful woman both inside and out. She very much stood behind Anderson when this was happening.
You mentioned that in the beginning, before this sexual assault charge came up, he was being considered as a principal of Merrimack High. But after this, he was not in consideration and he retired and went into the cleaning business and purchased eventually 4 ServeMaster franchises.
That is correct. The Salem High School conducted their own internal investigation and they told no one the results of that investigation that I am aware of. But he retired from teaching and being the athletic director at the end of that school year, and he never got the job as principal of the other high school.
Now, you write about, and as we mentioned in the synopsis, was about Charles Stewart. This is October 23rd, 1989, and there's the dispatcher hears, I need help. My wife's been shot. Tell us about Charles Stewart and what happens October 23rd, 1989.
Charles Stewart was allegedly having an affair with one of his helped. He worked in Boston at a well-known furrier on Newberry Street. And like Anderson, Stewart was very concerned with money. His wife was 8 months pregnant, and they had gone to a birthing class at Peter Brigham Hospital. And on the way back, he said he was accosted by a black man in Boston who shot him in the stomach and shot his wife. And she died within 24 hours. But one of the things, he really didn't want to have a child. Charles Stewart didn't really want to have a child because his wife, who was a very successful tax attorney, would have lost her income. It was no FLMA at the time.
You talk about also that there was a brave and courageous emergency cesarean performed, and a baby boy was delivered 8 weeks premature. However, that baby only lived for 17 days and suffering from oxygen deprivation in the womb.
Yeah, that's correct. It was really tragic. And the mother and baby boy were buried together. And the baby boy, the parents took her name on the gravestone. They wanted nothing to do with Charles Stewart.
Now you talk about this. He says that there's a black man and raspy voice, black jogging pants with red stripes. So the city is outraged at such a crime. And so the police conduct their investigation. You write that Charles is in the hospital. He writes a heartfelt eulogy because he can't attend a funeral.
I'm sure he had this all planned. And wow, during this time period, from October until January, when Charles Stewart was eventually found out, the Boston police were flooding the minority neighborhoods of Boston. At the time, Mission Hill, Jamaica Plains, Roxbury, and they were just doing typical stop and frisks. They made one arrest of one person, but they didn't have enough evidence, so they let him go. And they just could not find someone.
You write that they arrested a homeless man, however, squatting in a vacant building, and they found the black jogging suit in a pan of water, and he had a raspy voice, so he fit somewhat. You say he was soon released.
Yeah, that's correct. It was nothing more than circumstantial evidence, and the Boston police further investigated that individual and determined it wasn't he who did the murder.
Now, on December 28th, Charles Stewart has a lineup in front of him. He identifies a person named Willie Bennett. Tell us about this lineup and who Willie Bennett is.
Willie Bennett had previously been in jail for shooting a Boston cop. He was out on parole. And I think that Stewart had some foreknowledge of who Willie Bennett was. So we picked him, and Boston police said, okay, we are going to arrest him, and we have a man. And I spoke to a friend of mine who was a Boston police officer at the time. And he told me that they were really happy to get Willie Bennett off the streets.
You write that only 5 days later, though, 6 days later, as you write, the shoe drops and Matthew Stewart comes forward. What does he have to tell police?
Matthew Stewart is Charles Stewart's brother. And Matthew Stewart was the person who met Charles Stewart after Charles shot his wife and then himself in the stomach. And Charles gave Matthew the gun and his wife's pocketbook. And Matthew got rid of those. He threw it off a bridge in Revere, both the pocketbook and the gun. And he kept his mouth shut all the time during the investigation until Willie Bennett was arrested. And Matthew had a case of the conscience, and he said to Boston police, you've arrested the wrong man. It was my brother who did it, and this is what happened. So they ended up putting out a warrant for Stewart's arrest.
And as you say, too, the black community now with this knowledge is outraged.
Understandably so. Yep.
Hundreds of blacks were harassed and demeaned. What happens the next day?
They find Charles Stewart's abandoned on the lower deck of the Tobin Bridge, which goes over the Mystic River. He left a suicide note. It was later confirmed that it was his handwriting. They did a search of the Mystic River and Boston Harbor, and they found his body. And it was labeled as a suicide. But there's a little bit of a twist to that.
And what's that twist? There's a rumor that you read about.
Yeah, I saw it on a number of websites. And again, friends I've spoken to in Boston police confirmed the rumor, and they were divided as to whether it really happened. Supposedly, Stewart's wife's in-laws owned a sub shop in the Boston area, and they were somewhat connected. The rumor on the streets and a number of websites said that Stewart's father-in-law contacted some wise guys. They broke into Charles Stewart's apartment, made him write the suicide note, then drowned him in the toilet bowl. They then took the body of Charles Stewart and his car to the Tobin Bridge and threw him over the bridge. From what I was able to glean on the coroner's report, the autopsy of Charles Stewart, there was water in the lungs, but it was never tested as to whether it was fresh water that would be present in a toilet bowl or the brackish water of the Mystic River. So that rumor is still pervasive today.
Wow. Now, in terms for this story here, there are people that the police, the authorities, that look into the background of this case to look for motives for Charles Stewart specifically. So what do they find in terms of some very interesting things that we will use to compare and other people will use to compare the Charles Stewart case to the Robert Anderson case later?
The first one was he was allegedly having an affair with a woman who worked for him in the Ferrier shop. Charles Stewart was the manager, not the owner of the Ferrier shop. And he had stolen a gun, and that was the gun he used to kill his wife and shoot himself in the stomach. When this alleged affair came out, and the woman who Stewart was supposedly having the affair with denied, and said, "We were just good friends and nothing ever happened."
Right.
And again, like Anderson, Stewart was obsessed with money, and he didn't want to have his wife lose that income while she was caring for the baby.
Do we mention, too, that he had stolen the gun from the Furriers?
That's correct. Yes, he did steal the gun.
Okay, now you take us to January 1992. Just before that, you write that police recruits would study this case, and this made international news in certain places. And you say that police recruits were not the only ones who studied the Stewart murder case. This is what you write. You say Robert Anderson took note.
Fred Riault, the lead detective from Salem, New Hampshire, who assisted Lawrence police where the murder happened, in his interviews and talking with Anderson, and he also talked to some friends of Anderson, and he felt that Anderson had studied the Charles Stewart murder case, and he would not make the mistakes that Charles Stewart did, such as confining in brother. But they felt, Fred Riault felt that, yep, this guy studied the Stewart case, and he copied the murder.
You take us to January 1992 and Wendy Jack, and you say that they are friends with Bob and Amy Anderson since student teaching days in 1975, and Bob was entrusted to check on their place while they were on vacation. He had a key to their house. What had Wendy Jack forgotten about in that house?
Her father was living with them, and he died. He was elderly. He was 91, I believe. And when she was going through his belongings in his room in that house, she never knew about the 25 caliber gun. And that was the gun that Anderson used to shoot his wife, amongst doing other things to her. Actually, not shoot his wife. He ended up leaving the gun there at the murder scene.
You take us in this chapter you call the 24 Days of Christmas. This is October to November 1993. And Bob Anderson, as the service master company director, gets an angry call from a customer about a job not done well enough. Tell us about his visit to this apartment, who he meets, and this major character in this story.
The customer's name's McAvoy, and they had complained that his company, ServPro at the time, ServMasters, did a cleaning of their apartment, but there were still some stains left in it. So Anderson went there, knocked on the door, and the daughter answered, Pam. And right from the get-go, he was totally infatuated with her. He said he would send his best team to clean the apartment all over again, or to take care of the stains that were left behind, which they did. And he eventually asked her out to lunch.
At lunch, he got some information about her financial situation, but also that she was a very young and attractive woman. And he talked to and offered her a job. What was this job? that he described?
She was a single parent, and she was living there with her parents, and the parents would babysit the child when she worked. She had a small retail job. Anderson offered her a position in his company as marketing and paid her a fair amount of money at that time. And her job was to accompany him when he went to see clients. He asked her to dress in a very sexy manner, wear short skirts, high heels, because he said that sex sells. And that was her job. And she testified later on in court. She didn't have any qualifications for that. And she never did anything more than go with Anderson to see clients and then sit in provocative manners when Anderson was talking to clients.
One of his trusted employees you introduce is Bill Prince. Who is Bill Prince in relation to Robert Anderson? And he's part of the cleanup crew.
Bill was a former student of Anderson, and he went into the Marines after high school. When he came out, he sought out Anderson. Anderson was one of his favorite teachers. The boys in school loved him. The girls, there were a lot of mixed feelings. Supposedly, what he did to Cindy McGregor, he had done to one or two other girls, but they never came forward until he was arrested later on for the murder of his wife. But Prince was offered a job by Anderson, and he turned out to be one of his best workers.
This idea that he introduces Pam McAvoy to his 24 Days of Christmas, he had said to her that he had introduced this plan to give gifts to his wife and his child from December 1st to December 24th. And so he said he was going to do the same with her. What kind of gifts are we talking about here?
Exactly. He gave her gifts anywhere from, you know, a teddy bear to expensive jewelry to taking her out for dinner in Boston and then going to see a play afterwards. He spent a lot of money on her.
Amy became aware of this and questioned him and was concerned about the relationship. What did he say this relationship was?
He said that the relationship was totally platonic, nothing more than employer-employee, and he felt really bad for her because she was a struggling mom, and just he was trying to do his good deed for the day.
Anderson has a bookkeeper and family friend, and she notices the additional credit charges recently. And his mood changes, she says he was more brooding. She asked him where the new money in the account was coming from. What was his answer to her?
He said, essentially, you got to spend money to make money. We're doing a lot of marketing. We're going on business trips. He had taken Pam McAvoy to a trip down to Worcester where they stayed for a night. What they did there that night is still up to debate. Like Charles Stewart's alleged affair, Pam denied that they ever had any carnal knowledge of each other. Talking to the investigators in the case, both in Lawrence and Salem, they're split as to whether they were actually having an affair or it was just platonic.
Now, another character is introduced, Judge Bob Marshall. He's the president of the local Kiwanis Club. He's known Robert Anderson for about 10 years, but he has no choice in his mind but to call police. What's this all about?
When Bob Marshall, who was well-loved by Salem police and everyone else in Salem, he was the president of the Kiwanis Club and noticed there was $50,000 missing that couldn't be accounted for. Fred Riault got involved in the case, and lo and behold, Robert Anderson was the treasurer of the Kiwanis Clubs.
Mm-hmm.
So what they felt very strongly, and Fred said he had more than enough evidence to issue a warrant and get a conviction of Robert Anderson for embezzling that $50,000 from the Kiwanis. But Judge Marshall chose not to go forward. And instead, Anderson was forced to leave the Kiwanis, and the Kiwanis didn't want to go forward because that would give them a very bad name, and they felt that it would hurt contributions. And I can't speak highly enough about the Kiwanis in general, and particularly in Salem, New Hampshire. They do really good work with a lot of donations to charity, but they didn't charge him. And Anderson got away supposedly with $50,000 that he was supposed to pay back. That was an agreement he made with Judge Marshall that he would pay back that money. But circumstances eventually prevented that.
You write that meanwhile in Methuen, Massachusetts, there's some frozen pipes are especially good for Winter and the service master and Robert Anderson's business. And he goes to a door for somebody that has made a call that he's done some work. Francesca Lopez answers the door. Tell us about his interaction with Francesca Lopez.
Well, this goes back to what I said earlier, that the best judge of future behavior is past behavior.
Right.
He goes into the family house and sees Francesca Lopez. She's 17 years old, and he is, once again, totally enamored by her. And he offers her a position as a marketing specialist. That's what he called it, marketing specialist. He ends up fixing, cleaning everything. He sends a crew in. He came in himself, and he asks Francesca, "No, I'll give you a fair amount of money again. And could you accompany me? I have this client in Londonderry, New Hampshire, and you can see what the job entails. Could you dress very sexy, wear a short skirt, high heels, and plunging neckline?" So they end up going to Londonderry. She agrees to this. They talk to a client there, and Anderson then tells Lopez, "All right, I'll bring you back to your family home." And allegedly what he did was molested her in the van. She pushed him off, ran in, and told her parents, who the father wanted to kill Anderson. So the very next day, like the McGregors, the Lopezes went to the local police station, Methuen, Mass., and spoke to Peter Reno, who's a good friend of mine, very good detective. And Peter took up the case. And they had a warrant for Anderson's arrest that was eventually served in Salem, New Hampshire, with the summons to appear in court. And again, future behavior and past behavior. Anderson went to one of his employees, a female, and said, "Hey, listen, my wife's going to divorce me. This didn't happen. This girl is making allegations that never happened. I need you to say you were in the back seat of the van and say that this never happened."
Now, how do police react when they learn that this Linda Stevens, are they suspicious, and how do they act accordingly?
They're very suspicious. They are very suspicious. They feel that this didn't happen. At some point, Detective Phillips from Salem had gotten in touch with Pete Reno. There was a lot of cross-border work amongst the detectives in Methuen, Mass., and Salem, New Hampshire. They border each other. And Phillips had told Reno about what had happened in 1984 with McGregor, and they end up playing good cop, bad cop, and Anderson's employee eventually admitted that, yeah, this is what Robert Anderson did, and he pretty much forced me to lie for him. He's my boss, and I didn't want to lose my job.
Absolutely. So they don't involve her in this. You write that February 11th, unlike in 1984, Amy Anderson is very upset and not very supportive at all. And she was talking now about divorce. And so over the next 2 weeks, you write that he tries to smooth over relations with his wife. But by the end of February, however, she's still considered divorced. You know, energy drinks just make me jittery. I drink coffee, but I find that more than one cup a day doesn't really do that much for me. In order to do interviews with authors, I first start with reading their entire book. Typically 300 to 400 pages. And then I go back and I make about 25 to 30 pages of notes. The week I started to drink Magic Mind, I happened to have two episodes scheduled, meaning two books to read and two interviews to do. After taking Magic Mind for just a week, I recognized that I was more productive, I felt sharper, and I was overall in a better mood that week. It gave me more mental energy, more mental stamina. Magic Mind has all natural ingredients, no sugar, nut free, vegan, keto, and paleo friendly. It contains matcha, nature's extended release caffeine. Magic Mind has nootropics and adaptogens, including lion's mane mushrooms and ashwagandha, among other important ingredients that address memory, cognitive ability, stress, and inflammation. If you're like me, a person looking for something natural that gives you real mental energy, I totally recommend you try it. You can get it at magicmind.com/truemurder with my code TrueMurder20. You also get up to 56% off your first subscription or 20% off your one-time purchase. That's TrueMurder20 for 56% off. It also works if you're already a subscriber. You save on your next subscribing payment. If you're not feeling 100% some days also, I would really encourage you to try it out. So it's www.magicmind.com/TrueMurder and get up to 56% off your subscription for the next 10 days with my code TrueMurder20. I'd get the 30-pack if I was you. It's the best value. Now, you write that in January 24, 1994, another important character in this story, Rebecca O'Brien, calls, and she's not happy with service master job done a few days previous. And they had moved in and out of this house when this cleanup was going on by service master. What did she notice after the visit regarding her husband's property?
9mm gun was missing. Jeez, I wonder how that happened.
Right. And also, you write that there was a burglary reported at Industrial Park, and security guard didn't see anything except he thought he saw a service master van, but he wasn't quite sure.
That is correct. It was some cleaning equipment was stolen, and they really didn't have any suspects outside of that maybe elusive service master van.
You take us now to a very important date, February 25th, 1994, and the site of the Shawmut Bank and the manager, Judith Smith. What's going on there with Robert Anderson?
Well, it was a cold winter and she had burst pipes in the cellar. And so she needed Anderson's crew to come in and clean everything up.
There was an issue where a restaurant that had gone out of business was next door, a Cherry and Webb, and there was a heating and cooling ducts were connected between the buildings. Tell us what happens with Robert Anderson and Paul Medola at this bank.
Paul Medola is the custodian, and Anderson said, there's a dust problem. And Shawmut Bank and Cherry and Webb share the same ventilation system. So could Medola let me in? He's saying this to the bank manager, and I just want to check everything out. So they end up going into a boiler room. Anderson is there alone. Medola is doing other custodial things. And eventually they leave the building, and Anderson says, oh, damn it, I forgot one of my tools. Medola gives him a key to the Cherry and Webb's building, and Anderson said to him, okay, I'll give this to the bank manager when I'm done, but he never did that. So he ended up having the key to Cherry and Webb's.
You're right that night, Bob and Amy Anderson go out to meet their good friends, longtime friends, Ray Corliss and his wife, Julie, at a restaurant, and they seem to be a happy couple. Julie, though, however, sees something amiss at the end of the night.
Yeah, she felt that all was not well in paradise, and she related this to her husband. Her husband was the principal of Salem High at the time, again, very well respected, and he said, oh, no, everything's fine, and he had no idea what was coming down the road.
You're right. February 26, 1994, it's 6:54 p.m., and the Lawrence Police Department dispatcher answers. She's asked, what's the matter? What kind of response does she get on the line and from who?
It is a frantic male voice. That male voice is Robert Anderson, and he's saying, my wife has been killed. She's in the van behind the Shawmut parking lot. Send help. I love my wife. She's hurt real bad.
Who is there and who do they speak to? And what is the condition, obviously, of Amy Anderson?
Patrolman Arthur Waller was right around the corner in the police station. The police station and the fire station were about a block and a half from the Shawmut Bank. They get there, it starts snowing lightly, and Waller just calls that. Help, we've had a very brutal murder. Amy Anderson was in the driver's seat of the van. She was stabbed multiple times with a blunt object that turned out to be a Phillips screwdriver. And she had some very serious slashes on her head. It was amazing that she made it to the hospital alive. She made it through the night. Waller radios in that, okay, we've got a serious murder here. It's brutal. and I need detectives. Brian Baroukas is the first detective on the scene, and the first thing he notices is the only tracks in the snow. And again, it was a very light snow. The only tracks in the snow were the tracks leading from and to the van and no other tracks outside of Patrolman Wallace. Brian had was also in the station, and he had gotten there before the ambulance came. Unfortunately, he didn't take any pictures of that.
So they also speak to William Prince, and they also get Robert Anderson's story of events. What is the difference in those stories or the similarities?
Well, William Prince is downstairs with another employee there cleaning, and he testified that, no, Robert Anderson had asked Amy to go buy some coffee and everything, some refreshments for the crew. But the crew said, oh, no, we don't need it. We're only going to be here about an hour and a half. Oh, no, we need it. And I'm going to walk Amy out to the van. And Amy said, there's no need to. The van's just outside the back door. And Anderson said, hey, this is Lawrence, and Lawrence is very violent, which they were having a spate of serious crimes. Lawrence does have a high crime rate. So he said he was going to walk her out to the van. He came back in 20 minutes later. They're asking, geez, where's Amy? She was just supposed to go right down the road. Robin Anderson says, let me go out back and check. And that's when he comes screaming back into the back saying, Amy's been hurt. She's hurt real bad. I've got to call the police. And right from the get-go, he blamed it on the violence of Lawrence.
How did police conduct their investigation and knowing that Robert Anderson is their likely suspect in this?
They interview everyone there, and they can't find any tracks anywhere in the snow that's on the sidewalk or anywhere else at the time. They also noticed some tracks leading into the Cherry and Webb building. Again, that was adjacent to the Charmant Bank. However, that didn't register right away. So now they want to interview Anderson. Amy had died. She lived through the night. It was amazing she lived that long. She lived till 6:30 the next morning. And they asked to interview Anderson. So he comes into the police station the following day at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Now, they're looking for three different weapons. And when they do the autopsy, it is revealed the extent of this angry, more than angry, assault on this woman. So tell us about the injuries that were inflicted by these three different weapons.
They had some serious slashes in the scalp that went down to the bone. There were puncture marks in her face and in her shoulders. And it wasn't caused by a knife, these puncture marks. It was by a round, blunt instrument, similar to, say, a screwdriver, whether it be a straight or a Phillips screwdriver. And they couldn't find the murder weapons at the time.
They decide to make an arrest. There is a wake planned for Amy and a funeral. When did they decide to make an arrest on Robert Anderson?
It was that Thursday night at the wake. The funeral was going to be the next day. And both Salem police and Lawrence police are going to wait. They're putting surveillance on Anderson. And they're going to wait till after the wake. However, Amy Anderson was loved. It's the middle of winter, and the line is out the door, into the parking lot, and down the street. There was about an hour and 20-minute wait. So it was getting 9:30. The wake was supposed to end at 9, but they prolonged the hours. The funeral home prolonged the hours, and they decided to just go in and arrest Anderson. And again, there were Salem police. Detective Phillips was there, and they went in and informed Anderson that he was under arrest for the murder of his wife. And Anderson said, really? You had to do it now. Now you couldn't wait till after the funeral. And Phillips looked him squarely in the eye and said, Robert, if it wasn't for you, there wouldn't be a wake and funeral. And at that point, Amy's brother, who never really liked his brother-in-law, lunged for Anderson, and he was held back by police who were there. And they put the handcuffs on Anderson, marched him out of the station. And as he's being marched out of the station, the principal, who had dinner with the Andersons, Corliss, said to one of the detectives, Fred Riott, Fred, I hope you know what you're doing. And Fred just stopped and looked at Corliss and said, you know, when it comes to first-degree murder, I always know what I'm doing.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in business into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Now, he is set to go to trial. The issues that are very important is that a blood splatter expert, Morgan Dexter, does an analysis of the jacket. And despite him cradling his wife's head and blood being on the jacket, you talk about three different types of stains: impact stain, transfer stain, and a projected impact stain, them all being different and all basically being damning testimony at this trial with this analysis of that jacket.
That's correct. What she testified, which was very damning evidence, was that when you stab someone, there's going to be blood spatter, and that blood spatter is going to come back on the person who did the stabbing, particularly if it's a blunt instrument more so than, say, a knife with a sharp point. And what this spatter looks like is a blob with a little tail at the end. And that is exactly what Anderson had on his jacket. That evidence was overwhelming, and it obviously turned out to be Amy's blood.
Very interesting. It's very important that they find the murder weapons themselves. They go to visit Judith Smith at Shawmut Bank, and she hadn't found, or Red police had found, murder weapons. And she was asked if she was ever given back the key to the Cherry and Webb store.
No. So they eventually let detectives, Jack McDonald from Lawrence was the lead detective. They let him back into the store, into the Cherry and Webb building. And the custodian, Modolo, said, hey, listen, he spent a lot of time in the boiler room. So they go into the boiler room. They're looking around. There's high ceilings, 10-foot high ceilings. It's dropped ceiling. And one of the other detectives notices a brown stain on the floor. And that's what happens to blood when it coagulates and dries. It's a brownish red. He notices, he looks up and notices that one of the ceiling tiles is askew. They find a ladder, he goes up, and that's where they found the murder weapons. So evidently, after Anderson had killed his wife, he went to the Cherry and Webb store. Those were the footprints in the snow, and deposited the weapons in the ceiling. And those weapons had fingerprints. There was the 25 caliber there also that had a smudged fingerprint and had Amy's blood. So Amy's blood on the murder weapons, Anderson's fingerprints, they got him.
You were asked by Fred Riehl to look at this case because of your background. Tell us about your background that comes into play in this. And also tell us about the assets being tied up. Give us this strategy that you had.
Yeah, my background is I have two master's degrees, one in business, another one in economics. And I was working in the business world and got tired of the business world, became a cop. But I also started teaching college economics and finance classes, particularly accounting. So I said to Freddie, hey, listen, he's going to be spending a ton of money on a team of lawyers. We have to find out where all his accounts are, and we have to freeze those accounts so he doesn't have access to that money. Again, I was teaching accounting. We ended up looking at Anderson's books. It was easy to confirm that the $50,000 he had previously stolen from the Kiwanis went into his checking account. The Anderson family lawyer, Jimmy Caponito, worked his ass off. They found out where his assets were, and they also found some safety deposit boxes. We had stashed away a lot of money and jewelry, and they froze all of those assets. So Anderson didn't have access to any of the money that he so valued so much. Right. And he had to get a public defender.
Now, take us to the trial. He has a competent attorney named Carney, and they have an idea to vigorously defend him. The prosecutor is McCallery, and he thinks a significant and evidence to be able to convict this person of first-degree murder, life with no parole. What are the key things that happen at this trial in terms of Robert Anderson testifying?
Carney was probably one of the best trial lawyers in Massachusetts at the time. And he did the case for free. He did pro bono, as they like to call it. I suspect he wanted to get the publicity, which he did. And what you typically do in a murder case is you try to put the blame on someone else. And that's exactly what they tried to do here. They tried to put the blame on William Prince, Anderson's former student and employee who was his best worker. And they attempted to do that.
They tried to put reasonable doubt that William Prince could have had the opportunity to kill Amy. And then they had a kind of sketchy motive why he might do that. He was jealous.
Yeah, the motive was that he was infatuated with Amy and she had spurned him, but there was absolutely no evidence to that effect, none whatsoever. He was always very respectful. As a matter of fact, after Amy died, he had gone to the house to pay his respects and was just there for a little while before he left. He's talking about Prince and finding out a little bit about his background. Great guy.
He tried to say that William Prince had come to the house the night of the wake and came in the house, saw him in the kitchen, and then a bloody key that was found later by Amy's sister was planted by William Prince. And he disputed this at trial on the stand and said he hadn't even crossed the threshold of that house that night.
That's correct. I mean, he never came further than the threshold. You know, he was invited in the house, but that was the key that was found by Amy's sister. I believe it was found in a flower pot that Anderson hid, and it had a bloody print on it. And they were able to get a partial print out of the key, but could have been Anderson's print, but they didn't have the 8 to 12 points of reference that you needed. They just had a few. But there was no doubt in any of the investigators' mind that Robert Anderson had stashed the key there.
It's interesting, too, that in the very first trial of the sexual assault, he was brazen enough to take the stand in his own defense. And at this, he insisted to take the stand, which is even more unusual. And they announced it early on, which is, again, unusual that he would be taking the stand.
Yeah, that's correct. Again, very arrogant, very arrogant. He found if you walked into the room, he felt that he was always the smartest person in the room.
It was embarrassing, I guess, for him, certainly, that Pam McAvoy also testified and said some damning things about him personally and legally.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, she said that he was wanted to have more in the relationship that she was willing to give, and it just wasn't going to happen. He also said that he was going to divorce his wife, but that was one of the things he was worried about, was that if she did divorce him, he would lose half his assets, at the very least.
It didn't take long once the deliberations. Carney was said by the prosecutor that Carney gave a fantastic closing argument. However, it only took 2 hours and 40 minutes for the jury to make the decision.
It was a really quick decision. There was no doubt in any of the jurors' mind that he was guilty.
So what was the verdict, the sentence? Where is he now?
The verdict was guilty, life without parole. And Robert Anderson is still in jail to this day.
And his appeals were upheld, so he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison.
Where he belongs.
I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this book, Murder Outside the Back Door, the true story of the murder of a popular Salem, New Hampshire teacher by her husband, the murder labeled as a Charles Stewart copycat. Thank you very much for this interview. For John, for people that might want to take a look at your other work, where could they go?
All my books are on Amazon. There is Murder at the Front Door, about a off-duty Hampton, New Hampshire police officer who had a 13-year grudge against his neighbor and killed him, and Murder by the Bathhouse Door, the story of three boys who incessantly watched the movie Scream.
Yes.
And wanted to see what it was like to kill. people to kill two girls, which they did at a park in Salem, New Hampshire. And again, they are available on Amazon.
Thank you very much, John Tomasi. Murder Outside the Back Door, the true story of the murder of a popular Salem, New Hampshire teacher by her husband, the murder labeled as a Charles Stewart copycat. Thank you very much for this interview, and you have a great evening and good night.
Thanks, Dan, and I always appreciate being here, and it's fun.
Always a great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you, John.
Bye, Dan.
Good night.